Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Now, today we've got a special co-host back, Mr. Brian Turnoff from the Mind's Eye Podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm imagining a digital applause right now, so thank you all.
I'll get the effects added in for you. Make you feel good. It's been a couple of months. What have you been up to?
Yeah, it's been a minute. You know, got the day job going on, the podcast, working on a book right now. So, yeah, I got a few projects in the works right now, so I've been focusing on that. But I always love coming back to here and appreciate having me as always.
Yeah, I'd be interested. What kind of book are you going to write? This will be your first, right?
It is. It's the exact opposite of pretty much anything that we're going to be talking about tonight, so apologies to Mr. Jensen. But it's going to be paranormal. It's historic ghost stories that stem back, you know, hundreds of years, and then it's there's a certain theme that's built into that we'll talk about when the book comes out.
Wow, it sounds interesting. And here we go. Now, today we've got really interesting show, I think. I've had our guest on before. Mainly it was about conspiracy theory stuff that was going on at the time. But today we got him because he's got a new book, Personal Effects, What Recovering the Dead Teaches Me About Caring for the Living. So Robert A. Jensen, thank you for taking the time for us today.
You're welcome. I always enjoy chatting with you guys.
So, Robert, now for the people that don't know who you are, let's explain why you'd be writing a book about this. What kind of work do you do so that people understand?
I've spent most of my adult life responding to what I call mass fatalities, disasters, crisis management, but typically those that involve a very sadly and tragically large loss of life, things like Oklahoma City, 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, the 2010 Haitian earthquake, or the Boxing Day tsunami, and I don't even count the number of plane crashes and bombings. So I spent a lifetime doing that, and there's a lot of lessons that have been learned, and I like to say that I'll never have to go to another event. I've been to two in my lifetime that have killed 250,000 people, and I hope that they don't occur anymore, and I'd love to never have to go back to work, but I don't think that's realistic. And what I'd like to do is help people understand what to expect and how to better manage crisis, because I don't think we always do the best job.
What got you into that kind of work? Was that something you've always aspired to get into, or did it just happen by accident?
I don't know if it was by accident. It wasn't an aspiration. I went to military high school, so I had a little bit different background to begin with, and then went to school in California and took criminology, was a deputy sheriff for a couple of years in school to pay for school, and got my commission, went in the Army. And I guess because of the law enforcement background in the Army, I got put into quartermaster corps, the mortuary area, and there was only one company or one unit at the time, and I commanded it, and that's when we had Oklahoma City. We were going into the invasion of Haiti. We had the Balkans in 95 and some high-profile political events, plane crashes, and I just happened to be there at that time. So it just kind of stuck with me that every time something happened after that, somebody said, oh, let's get Jensen. And I just went off from there. And when I left the Army in 98, I came to a company called Kenyon, which had started in 1906, whose business was basically doing the same thing. And I became CEO in 2003, and I liked the company so much I bought it in 2007.
Wow. Wasn't there a shaver or a guy? Who was that that used to have that
Gillette
commercial? Yeah.
That's why I copied from him. I hope he doesn't.
Yeah. Only a few of us are old enough to know that one. But, wow. So, but I would imagine this kind of work. Okay, now this is really commendable. Like, you were probably the one of the few guests I really admire because of this type of work you do, and you've done it for a long time.
Thank you.
But this kind of work, it must take its toll on you and the close people around you, like family or anybody like that. It must be kind of like, wow, that's a lot of grief involved with this kind of work.
Yeah, and I try to go into that a little bit in the book. It's, you know, I classify it almost as a memoir. It's kind of a, you know, it's going to be a different book to different people. But sadly, I think probably people around me have paid a bigger price than me, because I have a daughter, and she once, as a child at Christmas, she gave me a bunch of stickers that said, here's my dad's job. And it's, he gets a telephone call, he leaves, he goes to an airport, he waits for another telephone call and goes somewhere else. Because you never knew you were going to be home. I mean, and we had these 5-year cycles, 2001, of course. I just come back from New York after being up there for about 6 weeks. I was home for, you know, or 4 weeks. I was home for 2 nights, and Italy's worst air disaster occurred. So next morning I was a plane to Italy for the crash in Linate. And then spent probably 18 months off and on in New York City, along with going to some other events. And then 2004, the end of 2004, with the Boxing Day tsunami, the Christmas in the U.S. time tsunami that killed almost 250,000 people in Asia, I left and got back, and we had got Hurricane Katrina. We had a massive, very difficult plane crash in Crete. So it was me always being gone, and then when I was home, it's like the minute I come home, I got to clean up and pack everything because I don't know when the next phone call is going to ring. So you're never really off, and then when you own the company or you're the boss, you know, you're responsible for all the your employees, so taking care of the normal problems, making sure there's resources for them to do their job. And for that, for me personally, I don't know. I guess one day maybe I'll suffer some of the consequences. I can't control it. I feel very sorry for the dead. The best I can do for them is give them, I hope, to give them a name and dignity. But really what I try to focus on is the living and caring for them. And I go into it with an expectation that we can't make it better, because we can't undo the event. We can't bring back the dead. We can't uninjure people. The goal is to not make it worse. And that means telling people things that they don't want to hear. And most people don't want to know, but they need to know. And afterwards, they're actually, I think, a little bit relieved, because they can make a plan. They have an expectation.
You know, in some of these disasters you cover, like you've been part of effort, like things like that are man-made, like 9/11 and stuff, does that kind of make you angry?
No, because, you know, as a deputy, I learned some hard lessons pretty quick about people's behavior. And there's a lot of nice people in the world, and there's a lot of bad people. And the bad people are scumbags just because they're scumbags. It's not anything anyone's done. I'm not talking about the person who speeds. I'm not talking about a petty criminal who makes a mistake and says, oh, yeah, I need to do better. I'm talking about people who are violent, deliberate. And, you know, the people that we would interact with in Fresno County back in the 80s, there were some not so lovely people. And the one thing I always learned is, like, if I pulled over a drunk driver or somebody in the influence, I didn't try to argue and I didn't try to use logic because they weren't in the same place I was. So logic wasn't going to apply. And with some of the people, like the 9/11, and I did the bombing of the UN headquarters in Baghdad, and I think the worst are probably in the Balkans in 95, when I went into Tuzla and Sarajevo and that whole region, just as the war was winding down, and saw what I call industrial mass killings, mass graves. They're just some really bad people in the world.
Now, do you think the general public really understands what goes on after an event like that, like what the process is that you go through, or any of your team or people that help to clean it up, so to speak, or get a hold of the people, you know, survivors or survivors' families and stuff, like the whole process of what you go through. Do you think the public really, really knows what you guys do?
No, and more importantly, a lot of the practitioners don't, because they haven't been through it before. And that's one of the goals of some of the chapters in the book, to kind of say, here's what happens, here's what the expectations are. Because we're dealing with, and I'm sure you've talked about some of your shows, what we call the CSI effect.
Yeah.
Where, it's a plane crash, well, it's solved in an episode, maybe two episodes. Everyone's identified, everyone goes home, and life is quickly normal. And for us, and for the families, I say it's typically going to be at least a year process, because they have to get through all the dates. They have to get through all the holidays and understand that it's not a closure, it's a transition from what was normal to what will be normal, at the same time not having a really clear roadmap and maybe not having answers about their loved ones. So, I don't think the public, and again, I don't think practitioners necessarily have a clear understanding of what to expect.
You know, for me, Robert, when I was reading through personal effects, I mean, to me, the most sickening part, I mean, obviously the tragedies, I mean, they're sickening. You've been through everything, 9/11, Bali bombings, Katrina, etc. But for me, I guess what stuck out was that the most sickening part wasn't really the descriptions of the body parts, like strewn about, or the bloodshed that you describe, but really the bureaucracy and the response and the leadership of the governments to these disasters, the insurers, the lawyers, and air carriers. You know, for example, I think one example you mentioned was that American Airlines had their most profitable day on the day that one of their planes exploded, you know, when 300 people were killed. So, I mean, to me, that was like the most sickening part about that book. Do you mind going into that a little bit more and kind of expressing some of your sentiments toward that?
Yeah, and I always tried, when I wrote the book, I tried to be very careful, because I wrote it the way I try to work, which is I always imagine there's a family member standing next to me. And I ask myself, if I were that family member, would I be glad that Kenyon or Robert, somebody like me, was involved, or would I be unhappy and frustrated? And I always want the answer to be that I was glad. I was, I saw that there was respect and dignity, because I think that's such an important, human rights value. So I try to be very careful in the book about how I describe things. Leadership, and this becomes a problem at events, because, again, people don't know what to expect. And because of our system in the U.S. and a lot of systems, there's never a single person in charge. There are multiple people in charge of certain segments or functions. The problem is the family has to go through all those segments, and there's not a clear, well, this is your responsibility, this is my responsibility. That's where the families get stuck. And for the airlines, and I'm particularly harsh on U.S. air carriers, because I think they really earned the family assistance law with their behavior in the mid-90s, 94 to 96 very specifically. And I used the example with American Airlines. It was a DC-9 or DC-10 lost an engine. And the highlight was that, because of the way insurance is done for planes, it has a fixed value. So the insurance company will write a check 7 to 14 days for the value of the airplane. Even if it's not the real value, it's, you know, it's, in this case, the plane was very old and had, you know, its value had been written down. But because of the way the policy is, it was insured for, I forget what I put in the book, $26 million, something like that. But yet, families, the process for settlement can be so difficult. And if you bear with me for a minute, and I try to, again, go over this a little bit in the book, if you think of the settlement as, we have a value of life. An accountant could look at me and say, here's what I'm worth today. It has nothing to do with what I think I'm worth. It's based on, who do I support, how much do I earn, and my demographics. It's really not very subjective. And accountants anywhere can usually look at a person and come up with their value of life, not to be insensitive. So if we have insurance that covers that, why is it difficult then? Well, it's difficult if the families don't feel that people are talking to them or helping them. Their first call wasn't to a lawyer. Their first call wasn't to a newspaper. Their first call was to the airline to say, oh my God, my loved one's died. Help me understand what's going on. And when they're met with a wall of silence, when they're met with games, when they're met with, well, I can't tell you, then all that does is irritate them and drive them to the litigation. And litigation, to me, can be an extension of rage. The settlement doesn't have to be a difficult process. So families will get their solicitors, and the families or lawyers, and the family's lawyers will take a cue from them, or the families will take a cue from the lawyers. Then the insurance companies will have their lawyers. And to them, this is a process, billable by the hour, that can go on for years, remembering that the family that went through this is the one that didn't want this to happen as a moneymaker, would have given anything for it not to have occurred, but now needs to be whole, because guess what? There's still college payments, there's still mortgage payments, there's cost of living, life has to go on. And for a family who loses someone in a mass fatality, it can be difficult, because if we don't have a loved one right away, if we don't have an identification or disease, well, you can't close out bank accounts. You can't do legal actions. And so families can have their accounts locked, frozen. But the bills don't stop. So this is what I mean about not making it worse. And that story about American Airlines with the payment received for the airplane wasn't something they gloated about. It wasn't something they were happy about. It was to highlight that I wish they had taken that same understanding, or someone at American had looked at that and said, oh my God, are we doing the same quick settlement for the families?
And so part of your job isn't just, like, you know, the actual physical recovery, it's the emotional recovery. And part of that emotional recovery is, you know, the response from the governments, from, you know, the companies doing it. So part of that is managing that. But when, you know, kind of what I've noticed, or at least there were plenty of examples from the book where those companies, those entities, the government, they didn't respond in a way that was trustworthy or even honest from the start. And when you do that, that, you know, mistrust, anger is going to set in. And then once mistrust sets in, I mean, that leads to a pretty big slippery slope with conspiracy theories. And, you know, the reason I bring that up is because obviously with the 9/11 recent anniversary, that is part of the reason why there's so many conspiracies. I'm not going to go into my personal opinion of it, but, you know, I mean, when you managed the disaster of, you know, you managed 9/11, what did you see there that either, I guess, proves or disproves whether there was a conspiracy there? And kind of explain how, you know, either way with that. I mean, what did you see when you're at 9/11, and did that support anything with, you know, a conspiracy?
See, you always have to define, because you can have the conspiracy about the planning, and you can have the conspiracy about what actually occurred at the event. And so I have no knowledge, because I was involved in any of the research on, you know, how the planning of the hijackers, their entrance, their schools, what government backed or not backed. But what we do to answer these questions to families is we bring in technical experts. And I believe for 9/11, we actually brought in an architect or an engineer with a floor plan or a map to show families how a building could collapse like it did. And we're very careful, and I always look at a scene. And when I used to actually bury dead bodies to teach law enforcement, police officers, how to recover them, I always remind people, if you go to a lab and say, hey, confirm this, then in your mind, you've made something up. You need to take your specimen, your sample, to the lab and say, tell me what it means. You're the forensic person. Tell me what it means. You don't ever go into a scene with an idea what's occurred. You go into a scene and they let the evidence tell you what's occurred. And if you can't reach 100% conclusion, then you say you can't reach a conclusion, and you leave it at that. So for us, we bring in experts and say, this is how a building like this could collapse. These are where we made recoveries for people. These are what the evidence would show. This is what a wreckage would look like. I know on expectation you may have this idea that there'll be this big pit somewhere, or there'll be hundreds of pieces of an airplane. This is typically what happens when we see a loss. And I always try to relate to families similar events and set expectations about investigations. And, you know, the Swiss Air, Swiss and Canadians are well respected in the world. And Swiss Air 111, for example, the plane that went down September 1998, was a four-year investigation. You know, with $38 million. People don't understand that because the media doesn't report that. So it's about setting expectations for them.
Hmm. So what happens when a plane crashes? Why is it not what we think it is?
But so you have to look at the different people involved. So first of all, start with the boarding process. Airlines get boarding passes. If it's a domestic flight, they just have your name. The loyalty databases aren't usually connected, and loyalty databases aren't often up to date. So the airline doesn't always have a number to call. So you've got to call the airline. People under stress do different things. When I fly United, as you introduced my name as Robert A. Jensen, I always go by Robert A. Well, it's truncated, so I'm Roberta. Well, my family calls me Andrew. So under stress, they're going to call the airline and ask for an Andrew. They're going to say, there is no Andrew. So then the family's going to get mad. Then there's the jurisdiction. Who's in charge? Well, California has the sheriff coroner in almost all counties. Some have medical examiners, like Ventura, where we lost Alaska Airlines, or Humboldt, that has a public administrator. So you're going to have a different authority in each county. Louisiana has the Napoleonic Code, so their coroners have very different roles. Then you have the NTSB that will come in, and potentially the FBI. And they'll have to decide, first of all, who's in charge. Go back to TW-800. Is it a terrorist attack, a criminal event, or an accident? That determines who's in charge. Then all the agencies that come in to be involved with the fire, the rescue. So you end up with 25, 30 different agencies involved who all have different acronyms on the back of their jackets, who probably haven't done this except for one or two of the agencies. And then you have the families who are trying to figure out what's going on, and the airline who's in shock because they've lost their passengers, they've lost their employees. And even though I described some atrocious behavior, most people don't wake up to do a bad job. Most people don't go to an event and say, oh, it's my day to hurt a family. They're afraid. That scares people. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to make a mistake because they just had a mistake that was pretty costly. And a lot of CEOs I talk to, and I think I mentioned a few of these stories in the book, about how absolutely petrified they are to stand up in front of the families.
Hmm. What do you think that can be done better? I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of things, but I mean, what is there a particular sort of thing that you think should be regulated better or presented better? And is it really possible to do?
Well, I think it's always possible to do better. I think training, but you know, in restricted budgets, you're asking people to plan for something that may not occur. New York City, the 9/11 was the first plane crash they'd had in, gosh, 20 years. TWA hadn't happened in New York City. It happened in off the Mauritius, so it was a completely different jurisdiction. Suffolk County Medical Examiner, not the New York City Medical Examiner. So training is a little bit hard because you're asking people to train for something that may not occur in their jurisdiction. You're asking people to try to understand something that absolutely terrifies them. Earthquakes, you have the New Madrid Fault that runs up the St. Louis Valley in the central United States. It'd be horrific when it goes, and it will one day. So it's training, it's preparation for businesses. it's helping the business understand that families don't call their attorneys first. They call them first. So if you start defensively, you're losing the best opportunity you had to be successful.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And success in mass fatality is helping people through the process, because most of the blame isn't about what occurred, because most families understand that things happen. People make mistakes. Bad things happen. We can't prevent every criminal attack. It's not possible. We're not going to prevent natural disasters. But what they expect of the people they're facing is that you have a plan on how to deal with the consequences.
Book and takes it home and reads it. What is it that you hope they take away from it? What is it you want to get across to most readers?
Well, I hope, and again, probably different things for different readers. I hope it demystifies the process. I hope it gives a little more understanding, a little more tolerance for what the system has to deal with. I hope that for people who have friends, you know, God forbid, suffer loss, maybe we'll feel a little more comfortable about how to approach them, what to say, what not to say. It's hard to say because, again, it was written, I think, to be just, here's what's happened and here's how we're doing it and maybe how we can do it better. I don't know, what did you take? I think you guys have both read it. What did you take away? I'll turn the interview around. That'll be my
question. Oh, there you go.
Well played.
Yeah.
I'll let you take that one first.
Well, I sort of take it as, it's an understanding of what goes on in the process. It's an understanding of what you go through and your team, let's say. People in your position have to go through. It's giving us a point of view that we would never be part of. I would never see any of this or know about a lot of what goes on because so little is presented to us. Like, we get so little of that. It's kind of like, oh, here's the crash. This many people, you know, you get a couple of days of that, then they're on to the next thing. But you don't really understand all the process of what goes on the ground where the accident happened. So I think that, for me, that's kind of the biggest thing I get.
And, you know, for me, I mean, there was a lot of stories that stuck out. But to me, to kind of piggyback on that, is that, you know, what I found is that you were trying to obviously help, but you're trying to apply logic and rationale to something that is an emotional, that is something completely illogical and irrational. And how do we deal with that? And how can we respond to that and in which ways that we won't necessarily pin us down for life, in which ways that we can still move on and continue to do so.
Yeah, and that's good. Those were some of the goals of the book, and so I feel good about that. Thank you. And some of the other stuff for different people are, we're entering a phase where, my gosh, the anxiety level, people are analysis, you know, paralysis by analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't actually think the world's that much different. I mean, you look at England after the Blitz, or countries that rebuilt themselves after war. And again, I've been through the Balkans in 95. I was in Haiti in 93 after years of the embargo in New York City. And people forget in Oklahoma after the bombing, there were over 400 buildings damaged or condemned because of that bomb. I mean, it was the geographical damage was much more significant than the towers in New York. And people rebuild, and there's resilience. But I think people forget about what they can accomplish. And I think people spend so much time focusing on things they can't control. And have, at a point, almost confused convenience with necessity. And so we lose power for a little bit, and oh my God, it's horrible. What are we going to do? I've lost my phone. I've lost electricity. Well, it's a convenience if it's just hot or uncomfortable. It's a necessity if you have an oxygen generator that you need. But then you should have a backup plan. And I hope some of the takeaways from the book isn't a fear of, you know, going out in the world, but an understanding that there's a lot you can control, and that's what you should focus on, and don't worry about stuff you can't control.
Well, I'm staying home. I'm not going anywhere.
No, you live in California. I mean, you know, it's people shake or bake. We're having some horrible fires and times out there, but it's a great state, and people recover.
Yeah. Well, I've been up in my Canadian house there up in since the pandemic started, so it's been same sort of thing. Lots of fires here too.
So. And to continue kind of what you were talking about before, the randomness. And the control factor is that, you know, a question that you kept bringing up in the book was when someone is killed or, you know, has a near-death miss in a disaster, you ask yourself, was it luck or was it just not their time? And kind of like to me, what I took away from that is another way of saying is that, you know, is life and death random and chaotic, or is it organized and systematic? So I know you didn't really necessarily go into that, but you mind extrapolating upon those questions and you know, that notion that you kept kind of bringing up in the book?
Well, I use the example of, I'm in, you know, the water, you know, in Florida, the water's great. You go on a boat, sailboat, and you're going to, say, cross the Pacific, and one night a whale breaches, and your boat capsizes and sinks. And have you done anything wrong? Probably not. It's what happens when you're at sea. So now you're in the water, and you're on a life raft. And it takes 30 days for a passing ship to see you. So in that 30 days, if you had preparation, if you had water, if you had survival rations, if you had your boat set up for that emergency, and you lasted 30 days till the freighter, which is luck, sees you, then your preparation gave opportunity a chance to occur. Bad luck, the boat sank. Preparation was deliberate. Good luck that the freighter found you. But your preparation gave time for luck to occur. So I don't think people can, I think people sometimes hasten their time up. There's a lot of stupid behavior in the world. But there are times that you can't control it. So again, I don't worry about what I can't control. I don't, you know, when you're a deputy, you do the best you can. You want to go to work and you want to come home. Sometimes people don't want you to come home, but that's what your training's for. And sometimes it just doesn't work, sadly. But with a lot of things in life, you can give yourself an opportunity for better luck or better things to happen. The lack of preparedness, though, robs you of that.
Hmm. So the bottom line is that anytime someone's going on a trip, they've got to call up Robert.
No, the bottom line is just need to
be prepared. That's the last thing you want to do.
Yeah, no, when I show up, no one's ever, it's not a good thing when I show up.
That's normally the end of vacation, I would imagine.
Yeah, I was doing a World Travel Conference and Travel and Tourism Conference in Bangkok, and I think it's David Cameron had just been on, and then a CEO of a company, a really great guy. He gets on and he was talking. He says, yeah, and here's a guy who I hate to call. I never like to see him. It's like, no, I'm not sure I should think that, but I get it.
It's not the one we're looking for.
Yeah.
No, I know. When you go through these cases, which one has had, let's say, the most lasting impact on you?
That's a good question. And when I get asked a lot, my answer is, they're all different. You don't go to any incident and come back the same. You're always going to come back a little bit different. That's the cumulative effect that can make this work hard. It's, when you start holding a glass of water, if it's not so heavy, but you hold it up over time and add a little bit more water each time, it gets pretty heavy. But at the end of the day, none of them are about me because no one forced me to go, and I'm not going because something happened to me. I'm going because I was asked to go help. It really matters for the families because it's going to have the impact for them.
Yeah, there's no real difference once, death is death and death is death. But what about when it comes to actually managing the different type of disasters, man-made versus natural? I mean, would you say that there's differences there in your response, or it's really just all the same under one umbrella?
Well, the consequences, and again, go back to consequences. So sometimes in man-made, it's a little more controlled for other resources because you're not competing for life-saving. In natural disasters, you have to make a decision, like when we went into Haiti, how many people do I actually bring into Haiti? Because every person I bring is going to need food and water. And there's people who need food and water that don't have a choice where they are because they live there. So it's understanding the logistics of the differences and then crime scenes versus non-crime scenes. And almost all of them are political. They all have problems. They're just, each event will have its own special problems. The tsunami, we had 33 countries, and I can remember the first couple meetings where ambassadors were at these meetings from different countries, and they failed to react. One of the things I talk about in the book is a big problem with governments and people is they fail to recognize the crisis in a timely manner. They wait until it's much worse than it had to be. And, with the Boxing Day tsunami, 250,000 people killed, and several hundred from multiple European countries. And their governments, I don't think, could comprehend that such a thing could occur. And when it did, they were slow to react. And so we're in these meetings, and you get there, and they're saying, well, I'm responsible for, the Swedes, or I'm responsible for Germans, or I'm responsible for the Austrians. And it's like, as you understand that all we have here are several thousand deceased who are male or female. That's about all we can tell right now. So we don't know who's who. And if you're going to try to solve it by who's who, you're going to take a process and make it much harder than it has to be. We need a system. These are people of the world. We have 33 teams from 33 countries here. Let's just divide and start working out and working this. And here's the messages. But because they hadn't been through it and they were getting beat up at home. It's that fear that drives that reaction. So things like those are difficult, but different incident, different problem.
At this point in your life, where do you see yourself going? Are you going to keep doing this kind of work, or are you going to retire sometime soon?
Well, we've just actually sold the company. So I liked it so much, but all things have to come to an end, and it's time for a new generation of people to take hopefully the training, the education, and take the company and the system to the next level. There's some goals that need to be accomplished, but not by me. So I'll stay through the end of the year to help the public company that purchased it, which I thought was a good match. And then I want to share lessons. I want to, the point of the book, I want to help people understand stuff, and then I want to focus on things that I put aside that I enjoy. Photography, bike riding, scuba, travel. I'd like to be able to not have my phone by my bed and things like that, and not unpack a suitcase and then I come back and have my husband feel that we can plan something and the certainty it will occur, not worrying that, well, we're going to go. And I always use examples with my ex-wife once and my daughter. My ex-wife told my daughter, Daddy will be home. And my daughter said, no, Mom, Dad said he's planned to be home. So I don't want to have any more of those.
Yeah, it's got to be really hard on everybody around you in that way for that kind of... what kind of training does someone go through to get into that kind of job?
Well, I think that there's so many different fields. The management really is just, I guess, having the right personality or the confidence. I guess one of the things I don't suffer for is self-doubt. Not being arrogant, just being confident, because what people are looking for in leadership is confidence. But from the technical skills, there's a lot of feeder areas. I was a firefighter in Virginia when I was stationed there in the Army, for Prince George County. The deputy sheriff, law enforcement helped, spent a lot of time in morgues. The Army, with the logistics and the planning, funeral directors are a lot, social workers. It's really being a jack of all trades and understanding how each one impacts the other. There are very specific jobs for investigators, for example, but not all investigators are really good to talk to families. But a lot of them should be, because families need to understand the process.
Yeah, I mean, that could definitely be, that's one part of the process, but, you know, I'm going to drop and plant a seed here for you for your as you ride off into the sunset in Kenyon. Maybe one thing that you may look into or help people with is that a lot of, after these disasters, there's always a lot of scams. I think one that you mentioned is that when somebody died, a couple of men died, there was a paternity suit that came out after the fact, but one of these men were gay, so there's no way that could have, you know, obviously happened. So, but that is a common thing that happens after these disasters, these scams. I mean, what's one of the worst that you've seen, and how can we manage that?
Well, I mean, after the crash that killed the, that took out, you know, a good part of the Polish government, some of their credit cards were used. Some of the Russian soldiers who recovered the crash scene used their credit cards. It's sadly reminding people about all the protections that need to take place. The biggest part to me isn't the scams. It's the same problems we have in life fall us in death. And I'm a real big believer in a couple documents. Your passport shows that you're a citizen of a specific country or two or three countries, and that country is going to project itself to look after you. A birth certificate establishes your name, your identity. A marriage certificate, and this is why I'm so big on marriage equality, is not a religious document. It's a document that says, this is the person I've chosen to speak for me. This is a person I've chosen as an adult to replace or take over for the family I was born to. And so things like marriage certificates and then having documents, as if I were dead, what would I want a court to understand about who was to care for me, who was to make decisions for me? And, you know, 90, 85% of the families, that goes pretty smoothly. But it's the 15% of the families, or the 5 or 10% that I always say Mother Teresa would have problems with, where there's acrimony, there's bitterness, there's a lot of unresolved issues, and there's fighting. And what a horrible way to add to an already traumatic event is when you can't even decide who can make disposition of the deceased or who's going to take their personal effects, because we're fighting over who should that be, when the simple answer is the person involved could have left direction. We will all die one day. I hope for most of us it's not anytime soon. But because I don't know when, I want to make it as easy as possible. And I don't want my husband, as an example, you know, having a husband puts me in a little bit different situation in some countries, in some states in the U.S. Texas trying to change that now. I want to make sure there's no ambiguity or no lack of clarity on who I consider my family to be and who is to make decisions for me.
Mm. So now the book, I'm sure, will be sold everywhere. Do you have a website up and running that people can come find you on and find out more about you?
Yeah, I created a website for me. It's just www.roberthjensen.com, and I put the books on there. I'm trying to get my photography. I've got thousands of pictures around the world I'd like to organize and put up just because I think photography is neat. And, I do kind of a what I call a reasoning blog, and where I'm trying to add more things on. You might want to consider this or think about this. There's nothing for sale. You can't buy anything on it because at this point I'm just happy to share. And then there's all the, like I'll post this interview when it comes out, and TV and radio. So if you want to learn more about mass fatalities or the history, there's some information there.
You going to have some dancing videos up there, too, or something?
No, but I have some old ones from even back in 95 from Oklahoma City, and I'll eventually put some from Bosnia, just because, this is always, everyone's always interested in what goes on behind the yellow tape, as I talk about the book, so I've got some videos of that, but no, none of my trips to Everest or in the water or anything like that.
Oh, Robert, if you want to see a disaster, just watch Alan dance.
I'm not good at
how would you manage that? That's a dance lesson?
I would just say, man, that's more power to you, and you can dance like no one cares, then that's, I'm impressed, because I have no coordination, and I can't sing. My daughter once told me that my voice was too special to be shared.
Well, that's a nice way to put
it. My ex used to say I used to hit every note with a sledgehammer, so I can commiserate there a little bit for sure.
I took a music class in college, and the professor offered me a C if I never darkened the doors.
Now you learn how to get through school. What do you? That's the pandemic thing. That's got to really take its toll on this kind of work as well, right?
Yeah, we had we unfortunately had to put in place some what I call massive temporary mortuaries for overflow, and we had to send teams to New York and some other places that just didn't have enough people to go into the homes to recover the bodies. The thing that concerns me about the pandemic, and I use crisis, so to me, there's the actual response phase, and then there's the dealing with the consequences, and I think we're just now finishing the response phase. It's kind of like there's been a big fire. The fire trucks are now being pulled back to the station. But the fire trucks, they got to clean up the hoses. They got to roll the hoses. They got to clean the gear because they don't know when the next fire is. So all those doctors, those nurses, those coroner's investigators, those epidemiological researchers, healthcare people, they're exhausted. And then the consequences are, I think the anxiety levels for people have gone through the roof. I think there's people who are never going to be comfortable. Well, was school a good option so I could work because my kids would always be in school? Well, I don't think a lot of people predicted schools would be closed for the length of period. And we've had pandemics before, and we'll have them again. They're not unpredictable. But I think people, because, again, that resilience factor, lack of resilience, are going to work the consequences of this, I think we're just now starting to feel. And I'm not optimistic. I see the ability to concentrate for people is gone. I see that you notice the little irritations that are now becoming much worse. People flashing, not flashing as in, all being a raincoat, but where they go from 0 to 100 for overreaction because of a simple request. And to me, those are all manifestations of people's ability to cope, being exhausted. And I think that's what we're starting to see with the consequences. I also worry very much about the education system, because kids at different ages always suffer trauma or grief very differently. And a plane crash will affect a lot of people, or bombing. But meet a person in the world who hasn't been impacted by the pandemic, either economically or through a personal loss, or they knew someone who passed, or they knew someone who almost died. So it's affected everyone. And so there's not really that reservoir you can go to and say, help me out here, because you didn't go through this, and I'm going through it, and I need some help. We'll get through it. But it's going to require some real strength.
Yeah, it's been quite an event. Well, this is a very interesting conversation, as always. The book we've been talking about is Personal Effects, What Recovering the Dead Teaches Me About Caring for the Living, and our guest is the author, Robert A. Jensen. Thank you for taking the time.
You're welcome.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.